This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and SiriusXM Channel 371.
Last hour of this Tuesday show. Tom Luganville coming up in about 15 minutes. A kickoff eve edition of What Happens First. And you'll want to stay tuned at 9:45 for Roddy Jones's ACC kickoff memories. Friends,
yeah.
We go strolling down a lane of Roddy Jones wearing cargo shorts.
Let me just say, the fashion choices alone should keep you here. I mean, the fashion choices of a college student in the early teens, 2010 and 11. That alone is worth staying until 9:45.
And if any of you know Matt Bosher, get him on the phone because his picture is also priceless in the lineup. The former Miami punter and Pro Bowler with the Atlanta Falcons. Okay.
Oh, I mean, you're Matt Bosher. There's a Tyrod Taylor appearance.
There's
a Mark Herzlick hair appearance. Luke Kuechly may pop up. You never know who you're going to see at 9:45.
Because there were a lot of good players in the ACC and Roddy Jones.
Yeah. There will be one. There's one vertically challenged player in each of those pictures. And I'll just let you guess who it is. But, you know.
and he wears number 20. Okay. Let's get to the toughest three-game stretch. Crackstaff has formulated some stuff here. Half dozen schools have really got a tough run of three games in the middle of the season. Some of it comes early, some of it comes late, but there are three game stretches in the ACC. And Roddy, I don't think it's a stretch to say could determine what their year looks like in some cases.
Yeah, and some of them are sort of symptoms of the schedule that they were dealt. Like where we'll start, with Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech's got the hardest schedule in the league. You've got Clemson, obviously, every single year. You've got Georgia and Notre Dame in the non-conference. But look at that stretch at the end. Boston College at Notre Dame, Georgia. By that time, Phil Jurkovec could be in the Heisman Trophy conversation. He could be in the first-round pick conversation, absolutely lighting it up. Obviously, Notre Dame will have it figured out by that point. They're going to be an excellent team no matter what. But they'll be solidified in who they are. And then the University of Georgia, who is a top probably four team for my money coming into the season. So that's tough. And look, that doesn't – we went with that stretch only because we couldn't go with the stretch of at Clemson, North Carolina, Pittsburgh to start the ACC. I mean, that's the schedule that Georgia Tech has. We could have put two three-game stretches on this list. I mean, it is it's a tough one for Jeff Collins and the Jackets.
Yeah, we start talking with Jeff Collins tomorrow. It'll be a lot about his rundown as much as it will be the players that will be taking on that challenge. It's a significant schedule. There is no question for the folks in Atlanta. Next is Florida State. Now, Mike Norvell was playing uphill seemingly all last year, Roddy, but there is a stretch here in late October and early November I'm not sure anyone would want to tangle with.
I think you're right. And had we gone toughest five-game stretches in the league, it may have been that five-game stretch at the end of the year for Florida State. You have to go to Boston on November 20th. We were there the last time in November Florida State went up there. It was right after Willie Taggart's firing, and they actually played well in the game. But it was in the mid-30s, and that is never ideal for a team from the South. The only good thing for Florida State is you get the coveted double bye before you get in that stretch. You have the true bye week, and then you have UMass the week before you play at Clemson, NC State, and Miami. So Florida State double bye before they go into that tough three-game stretch.
Wait, but I didn't recognize the double bye. I saw UMass, the Minutemen.
No. It says, like, it spells out UMass, but how you read it is bye week or open date or
Roddy.
Practice game. Like, that's how you read that. That's how you read that.
Come on now.
What? What'd I do there? Well, I thought we were in agreement here with that. Like, I thought this is what we did. You know, you get UMass, so you get an extra week of work.
Let's go to Pitt.
Can't scrimmage yourself, so Pittsburgh. You got to scrimmage somebody. It's UMass.
Pittsburgh is next. I'm moving on. Pittsburgh is next. These are, and again, you pick these three, and I agree with it. But I'll throw the roadie in Atlanta on there, too, because Pittsburgh seemingly, and Pat Narduzzi can certainly speak to this more than we can, somehow or another, Pittsburgh ends up in Atlanta a lot. Roddy?
Yeah, since Pat Narduzzi's been there, I think I've covered the Georgia Tech-Pittsburgh game in Atlanta about 7 times. I think I have. So Pittsburgh, for the second year in a row, goes down to Atlanta. The only reason they're not included in that stretch is because there's a bye week after Georgia Tech, right, but before they have to go back on the road to Virginia Tech. But let's not forget the way that Georgia Tech game ended a year ago with the handshake heard around the world that was broken down on the internet over and over and over. But that stretch that we just highlighted is tough at Virginia Tech, who we think is going to be very good. And then you've got Clemson from the other side and Miami. That's two of the top three teams in the Coastal potentially, and then obviously Clemson. It's about as tough a three-game stretch as there is in the league.
Can we flash that schedule back up there briefly, Alex? Because I want Roddy to look at the Pitt opener. That says UMass, Roddy. Is that a bye week? Is that some sort of – is there something else that needs to go there?
Oh, no. Wes, Pitt doesn't start the season until September 11th.
Oh, stop. That's ridiculous.
You're scrimmaging yourself. You scrimmage a team in a different color jersey, and then you go down to Tennessee to start the year. They're going to be 1-0 on September 5th, and you know, we'll just talk about how they got a bye to start the season and a win because of it. It's basically,
All right, thank you. All right, let's move on. Pitt's stretch at Virginia Tech, Clemson, and then Miami. Next up, Virginia. You see the start, 4-11 and 18, or 4-11 before they get to Carolina on the 18th. The Cavaliers stretch, though, Roddy, November 13th through the end.
Notre Dame at Pitt, Virginia Tech. I mean, look at that. You're fortunate that after the long trip out to Provo at BYU, which could have been included, you're playing at elevation. It's a long flight out there. Against a BYU team that, yeah, they're losing Zach Wilson, but they are always a tough out. And by the way, the history with Bronco Mendenhall plays into it. You get the bye week after that, and then you've got to gear up for Notre Dame at Pittsburgh, who, again, mid-November in Pittsburgh, who knows what the weather's going to be like. Probably not as bad as December, but could certainly be cold, may get some weather. And then Virginia Tech to end the season, obviously the big rivalry game that the Cavaliers have struggled in recently. That's a tough stretch. No buys, no second buys on the schedule for Virginia, though. We flashed up a couple of schedules that had two buys in there. No second buy for Virginia.
All right, let's go to Wake Forest. Deacons also November darlings in the three-game stretch.
Yeah, we're getting a lot of November action here because you have North Carolina in the non-conference game, which let's not get started on that, the fact that this is for the second time in 3 years. Wake Forest and North Carolina are playing a non-conference. We got to get rid of the divisions. We got to make sure that these teams play more often so they're not having to schedule non-conference games. That's neither here nor there. But having at North Carolina, NC State at Clemson, two of those three on the road, obviously three really good teams. By the time Wake Forest gets to this stretch, this is the stretch that's going to decide if Wake Forest is going to be for real in the Atlantic, because that NC State game is going to be huge. And obviously at Clemson is going to be an uphill battle. It really comes down to NC State. North Carolina is not really going to play into the ACC standings, certainly for the overall standings. But this is it's a heck of a stretch for Wake Forest in November.
You see that FPI has got Wake to win 8 of their first 10, by the way.
Yeah.
So you get to that last piece of the schedule, and it could be a really interesting.
And that's where you'd expect Wake Forest to really be hitting on all cylinders. Sorry, Wes, but for Wake Forest, I think health coming into November is going to be as much a story as anything. The past couple of seasons, they've just gotten worn down as the season has gone on, lost some big pieces due to injury. So where is the health of the Deacons as you get into late October and November?
I think that's a really good point. All right, last on this list before we get to Tom Luganville is Miami, and it's right at the front, Roddy.
Right out of the gate, when Michigan State is the easy game of your three-game stretch to start the year, you got a tough three-game stretch because obviously Michigan State, Mel Tucker's second season in a bit of a rebuild, but App State, very well. We talked a lot about Coastal Carolina out of the Sun Belt. App State, if it wasn't for pauses, COVID, that was a really good football team that played with Coastal Carolina last year. Mm-hmm. They're going to be one of, if not the favorite in the Sun Belt this season, a really good, really good conference. And then obviously you start off with Alabama, 8 starters returning on defense. Yeah, they got to shuffle the offense, but it's Alabama. So right out of the gate, Miami's got one heck of a stretch. Because whether you win or lose that Alabama game, you got to gear up the next week for a team that's going to be easy to overlook. But on the field, App State has got a lot returning from a really talented team a year ago.
Roddy, we'll get to this well before kickoff on the 4th. Miami's going to be the big underdog playing Alabama and Atlanta at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in the Chick-fil-A Kickoff Classic on September 4th. Manny Diaz is going to have to learn some things about his football team on the run here against that front three. In some ways, where's the Alabama game fit in your mind with Miami today?
I think Manny Diaz is going to want to see his team play to the not get overwhelmed by the moment, not get overwhelmed by the helmet, not get overwhelmed by the draft status of the guys that they're playing against. Is he going to go in hoping and expecting to win the game? Sure. Mm-hmm. Is it likely that they win the game on paper? No. Can anything happen? Absolutely. But I think the thing you want to see your team do is play hard, play fundamental, and make Alabama beat you. They are plenty capable of doing that because of the talent that they have and the coaching that they have. But if you give the game away or the moment seems too big, then I think we'll look at this Miami team different coming out of week one. If they go in there and they're poised and you're just getting beat because Alabama is a better football team, no one's going to blame you there. There's a lot of teams that fall in that category. But if you were to go out, turn the football over, self-inflicted wounds, guys running scot-free down the field, that's where Manny Diaz is going to get a little frustrated. And that's where Miami we would look at and say, I don't know if this team is ready. Right. But if they play well, then we're going to think, all right, that's who we thought they were. Let's go see them compete against teams that are in Alabama.
All right. Those will look at some of the tougher three-game stretches. We continue our countdown to the ACC kickoff coverage tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. We're less than 24 hours away now, by the way, from the start of our coverage.
Yeah. Whoa.
And we celebrate that with Tom Luganville next. Yep. Latest in off-season recruiting, now that the gates opened in June, who's taking advantage of it the best? Who are some of the hot coaches, and how important is the next 6 weeks to what happens once the season begins? The Blue Ostrich is next on Packer and Durham on ACC Network.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Durham's Tuesday program right here on ACC Network continues. Great to have you with us, Roddy Jones. And for Mark, we hope to get Pack back later this week. Get well, my man. Let's go live, shall we, to the inner sanctum of ESPN recruiting analyst and sideline expert Tom Luganville, ladies and gentlemen. There's the inner sanctum as we look at it. Lugs is ready for the ACC kickoff. I see fresh haircut and top line eyewear, Roddy, for Charlotte starting tomorrow.
Tighten it up a little bit.
Yeah.
You want the Cowboys tomorrow?
He is more than ready. Yeah, it happens. It gets going tomorrow. And Lugs, I'm glad you did all this to sit next to me doing SiriusXM radio. So I'll be able to see all that.
Yeah, let me tell you something. You don't know how fortunate you are.
All right. Let me say this. Yesterday I was working with Link from the Mod Squad, and today I'm working with Roddy Jones on the show, Lukes, because Roddy had gone for about 7 weeks without a haircut. He looks much better. Yeah. He looks like he's ready to be in your ballpark tomorrow, if you will, in terms of the look. So good for everybody there. If I'm going to give you one thing to tell me about that's been a headline since they opened the gates to recruiting in June, what is it so far?
I think NIL. I think more than anything else, all of this happened. We had the month of June, right, where you had contact and kids could be on campus and coaches could interact and coaches could coach kids when they come to their camps, right? And so you get all of these, this mad flood onto college campuses that had been lacking for the last 15 months. Then on top of it, July 1 hits, and now all of a sudden you start looking at recruiting a little bit differently because it's not just about the player-coach relationship anymore. It's not just about, what are the things that that kid identifies with. Now it's about the programs that were prepared for what was coming, all right, and built an infrastructure within their department on how to handle and navigate the NIL space. Because let's call this what it is, right, wrong, or indifferent, all right? Recruiting is no longer about identifying the best guy and then developing the relationship with that guy, finding out who the decision maker is, and then, hopefully signing him down the stretch. Now it's about presenting a 3 to 5 year plan on how we, the institution, all right, can provide maximum opportunities for you under NIL. So you're essential. This is no different than having a compliance department. This is no different than having, an athletic training department. You now have to have an infrastructure internally to manage this, deal with it, whether it's taxes, whether it's financial management, whether it's local opportunities, local commerce, businesses, endorses, the social media side of it. So now kids are starting to look at this as another factor in why they may want to go to school A versus school B. And that's the world that we're going to be living in now going forward.
Luke, you mentioned all the steps previously, and identifying the decision maker has always been important and probably still is. But how does NIL change the decision maker? Because you put those things out in front of me at 17 years old, my eyes are going to glaze over in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
How does that change who's making the decision on the back end for these recruits?
Well, here's what you hope. If you talk to college coaches, they'd love to go back 20 years ago when the decision maker was the parent and the high school coach. Okay, those were the two people that you dealt with that were the inner circle, that were the people that were in that young man or woman's corner and had all of their best interests at heart because they had a direct link to them. All right, where this kind of thing can get sticky and can get a bit dangerous is now all of a sudden the decision maker is a third party runner. He's a 7-on-7 coach. Mm-hmm. He's a local trainer that's been working with the kid since he was in the 8th grade. You don't know who that person is. You don't know if their best interest is at heart. You don't know if that person's trying to shop around for the bigger, better deal. All right. And then influencing that kid in relationship to that stuff. That's scary. If you ask me that's dangerous, dangerous territory, because here's what we can't forget in all of this NIL nonsense. And I retweeted a statement from a prospect named George Pedway, a running back. And he essentially, and I'm paraphrasing his quote here, he said, "I'm not worried about NIL because I only get access to NIL if I produce." And that is so unbelievably true. Yeah. Your value is based on your production. Your marketability is then based on your value. If you don't produce, have no value, you're not marketable. Now, are you marketable via social media in terms of having a following? Maybe so, all right? Maybe that gets you a YouTube channel and this and that. But to take part in NIL, at the end of the day, you've got to fulfill the responsibilities of your scholarship and actually perform to become somebody that somebody would like to endorse.
All right, I want to pivot here to what schools have done so far, because, Pac and I don't follow this. We lean on guys like yourself to tell us. But it looks like, at least, and I know some of the early rankings are still kind of being tabulated here, some of the ACC schools have done pretty well in the recruiting game, but there's some surprises here. Boston College has done very well. Florida mm-hmm. State looks like they're off to a very good start, enough to get some good smack talk with Manny Diaz going back and forth about recruiting. And Virginia Tech and Justin Fuente, in what some would perceive as a very critical year for the Hokies, Tom, look sure. like they're doing well.
Yeah, and I think let's start with the last one. They are doing well. But in order for them to continue to do well, they can't take a flop on the season. They have to continue that momentum by performing. All right, so the program looks like it's in an upward trend. And what the kids have been sold on, they're actually seeing come to fruition on the field. I think that's critical for Virginia Tech. For Florida State, I think they're selling a blank canvas. I think they're saying, hey, this is still an institution. This is still a blue blood program. Come here and make the difference. We need to phase guys out. We need to get new blood. We need to get a new environment. We need to have a different attitude and a different locker room. And that means you, as a young player, could come in and make an immediate impact. And what are young players attracted to? Playing right away. Boston College. Thing about Boston College that I think is really interesting is this didn't look like Boston College offensively that we've become accustomed to seeing over the last, 25 to 30 years.
Right.
They've recruited to that. They've recruited to the fact that we are going to look to bring in skill to spread the field and to push the ball downfield. We do want the ball into the hands of playmakers in space in the passing game. This isn't necessarily going to be, about 12 personnel or 22 personnel and just pounding away at people. And I think once they've sent that message, it's been well received, probably in some circles and some athletes that wouldn't have considered Boston College previously. I think that's really important. The one school that you didn't mention is Clemson, which I think is interesting because for me, and I think that the better you get, the more successful you are, the harder it gets because now everybody wants to come to your school, right? So we can pluck this guy, we can pluck that guy, we can take this guy and that guy. But are you taking the right guy? And we saw Alabama start to do this about 5 years ago. And that is you start to slow play because now you can be picky. You can be selective. You already know you're going to get the great player, but we've got to weed through these 10 guys to find the three that fit what we are. And if you start deviating from that path, here's what's going to happen. You're going to take good players that are bad people, and they're going to leave your program. And I think that's what Dabo and the staff are trying to avoid by slow playing it a little bit, letting it run its course. They know they're the king of the mountain. They know that they, have access to this guy and that guy. They've got to make sure they're selecting the right guy.
Hmm. Yeah. Luke, I want to ask about Miami, one of the schools that we didn't talk a lot about in terms of recruiting just a second ago. But Manny Diaz last year was able to keep some really big prospects in South Florida. Now, there was a lot of talk about whether that was because of the pandemic, whether that was because of the fact that guys couldn't travel all over, or whether it was something that Manny Diaz was doing, or a combination of both. Where do you see the answer to that? And do you see a trend where it continues that because of what Miami's done in NIL, because of the success that they've had on the field, where you do start to see some of these big prospects deciding to stay home more?
Well, I do think NIL could play a role. We all heard about the endorsement that they seem to be signing on for that's going to affect everybody that's on scholarship on the roster. Is that attractive? Absolutely, it is. Obviously, there has to be a quid pro quo to that as far as a player return on investment. But listen, the recruiting landscape in South Florida has become so flooded with everybody. I mean, there's schools in the Pac-12 recruiting South Florida. You've got the SEC, the ACC. You've got even the American Conference now that goes down there, and there's more to choose from. I do really think, though, that Miami having the year that they had on the field, the fact that kids could not leave and go take official visits at other places, couldn't leave and take unofficial visits, couldn't attend camps and combines on the road last year, couldn't go on other people's campus and attend a camp. All they saw was a successful Miami campaign, and it's what they were exposed to for the better part of, 12 to 15 months. I don't know how that couldn't play positively for Manny Diaz. And so now I think you've got to now take it to the next level from an on-field performance standpoint, because now the floodgates are back open. Kids are going to want to go and venture out here and go here and visit here. On the field this fall, you've got to give kids a reason to not want to do that.
Tom, given the almost exclusive angle you see college football from a player evaluation standpoint to team compositions, and when you look at the ACC, we're going to talk a lot about the romance of quarterbacks in the next 2 days and the power of that position in this league. Is there an area that we should focus on beyond quarterbacks in your mind from a player quality standpoint as we get ready to move into the ACC football campaign?
not from a player quality standpoint, from a team performance standpoint. Look at the turnover margin of Louisville, minus 12, Duke, minus 19, okay? We know Florida State was low on the turnover margin. You look at that top to bottom, you start Georgia Tech, all right? We watched Georgia Tech. I came on this program. There was a couple times you watched Georgia Tech last year when they didn't turn the ball over.
They're really good.
We're a pretty competitive football team.
Yeah.
So I look at this league top to bottom, and, yeah, we see the quarterback play, but what if all of a sudden Duke is now minus 7 in turnovers? Louisville is plus 2. All right, Georgia Tech goes even. What does that do to the top-to-bottom competitiveness of the conference? Because at the end of the day, the most important thing in football is what? The ball.
The football.
Do I have it or do you have it? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. So if you're not as talented as a Clemson or a North Carolina or a Miami right now, and you're going to be minus 12 in turnover, then you're not going to be very good.
Yeah.
But if you're in the plus territory there, you're going to be good every single week. And if you add the quarterback play on top of that, I think that's the one thing I'm looking at for on-field performance for this season in the ACC is how teams flip around their turnover margin.
Good stuff.
All right, Luke. Jim Phillips takes the podium at ACC Media Day. He's going to kick us off. What are you most expecting or looking forward to hearing from Jim Phillips in his comments at his first ACC Media Day?
Energy, enthusiasm, and genuine interest in the member institutions. You know, this is a guy I know from personal experience, having broadcasted several Northwestern games. You know, he's one of those ADs that when you come on campus as a TV crew, I mean, he just insists that you come up to his office. He insists that you sit down, visit. You know, he wants to kind of know how the ins and outs of TV work. You know, when do you get in town? When do you leave? When do all the meetings occur? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? There's a genuine interest. And I think his enthusiasm that will probably, for those who haven't been around and haven't listened to him, haven't seen him, are going to be very impressed with his presentation because he's a people guy. He's a people person when it comes to interacting. That's why I think he's going to be really, really good for the conference. So to me, I think when you engage with him, you're going to see a real likable guy that's going to have interest in you. And if that permeates through each member institution and their presidents and their respective ADs, then you're going to have a bright and positive future.
By the way, Roddy, it is worth noting that about 3 years ago, the term Blue Ostrich was born at the ACC kickoff when Tom Luganville showed up wearing, in fact, the Blue Ostrich boots. So do we anticipate seeing the Blue Ostrich tomorrow, Tom, in celebratory recognition of that day?
Well, it is an annual tradition now. I mean, so they will be on. I cannot guarantee I will go Blue Ostrich 2 days in a row.
No,
you never know. Camel might come out. Cowhide might come out.
Cowhide,
ostrich could come out. Lizard could come out.
Lizard, yeah.
Rhinoceros could come out.
Rhinoceros.
I mean, you don't know. I got to keep the people guessing.
Got to keep the people guessing.
We'll have to keep the people updated as well, because now there is a true, genuine interest on what that's going to be. We honestly should set odds. We should set odds on this.
Let's set odds.
What do we think is going to come out day two?
We'll give the categories. And we'll set odds.
There we go. Well done. Tom Luganville, Roddy Jones will be commanding the SiriusXM ACC 371 channel as we go to the ACC kickoff. Lugs, look forward to seeing you, my man. Thank you as always. Appreciate the visit.
Thanks, guys. Love it as always. Take care.
See you, Lugs.
All right. You bet. And our kickoff coverage from the fabulous Westin Hotel, Uptown Charlotte, friends, starts tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Jim Phillips to the podium at 9:30. And following his comments in the Commissioner's Forum, we will take you live with just about every coastal school, one form or fashion, players, coaches, analysts, guests, dignitaries, and celebrities all coming your way over the next 2 days. 9 a.m. tomorrow, 9 a.m. Thursday, right here on ACC Network and streaming live on the ESPN app. When we come back, well, on the eve of the ACC kickoff, we go to Bristol for an edition of What Happens First. It's next on Packer and Durham.
Packer and Durham. This is the Packer and Durham Podcast.
All right, Tuesday's Packer and Durham. We're in the final turns as we head to the ACC kickoff and our full coverage tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Cast of dozens will join us here on ACC Network. Time, though, before we get to Charlotte and the kickoff, we have to go with establishing some road marks, Roddy. And we do that with what happens first. And ladies and gentlemen, please welcome from the ESPN Worldwide Headquarters in Bristol, Connecticut, the maskless voice of victory, Josh Macri.
Good morning. Yeah, seeing my face on camera for the first time in well over a year, I just realized I got to do something about that second chin. True. Presented by Dish.
Josh, I said this when you came on, and we were comparing this to Drew's beard just a second ago.
Drew,
your beard game is strong, man. Like you haven't lost through the mask. You haven't lost the ability to trim and make the beard look really good.
Looks good.
And me being follically challenged on my face, I'm jealous.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely jealous.
I appreciate it. There's nothing else I can say. You guys flatter me.
I would just add this. I am so proud to see you keep the lumberjack tradition going, though, with your first full on-camera appearance in over a year. So
absolutely.
There you go. All right.
Absolutely. Well, I'm professional, at least in one aspect.
That's right.
Let's do a little what happens first here in the ACC. Of course, going into this season, the conference is not returning a 1,000-yard rusher or receiver for the first time in a decade. So what happens first this season? An ACC back eclipses the 1,000-yard mark, or an ACC receiver surpasses the plateau?
Question for clarity. Is both an acceptable answer?
Both is not an acceptable answer because one of them has to happen first unless they happen at the same exact second.
That is true.
I'm going to go rusher. I'm going to go 1,000-yard rusher, Roddy.
Ooh. See, and I even before you said that, I was going to go 1,000-yard receiver. And the reason I went receiver is because you look at the top backs in the conference. Jahmyr Gibbs, we talked about. Bam Knight, we talked about. Those two guys are going to split carries. Ty Chandler has the potential for splitting carries. Now, Mateo Durant, Christian Beal-Smith, those may be the two most likely. But I think you get a receiver before that. I mean, what was it? A couple years ago, Sage Surratt went over 1,000 yards in like 8 games or something like that. So I'll go receiver.
All right.
Thank you for not saying
both. Who do
you think
the rusher is going to be, Wes? That would be the other question. Who's the rusher going to be?
I like the idea of Mateo Durant, but I also think Mateo Durant, Ty Chandler, and I think Jahmyr Gibbs is going to rip somebody for a couple bills in one game too, Roddy. I think that's going to happen. Yeah. I think Jahmyr Gibbs is going to go off on somebody who, and you know this from playing with Paul Johnson, just line up the wrong way. Coach thinks he's got the best game plan to slow down Gibbs, and I do like that the thing we talked about last year with Jahmyr Gibbs and Jeff Sims was when they got the bootleg game going, you know, where they do the fake and roll stuff. And Jahmyr Gibbs is going to rip somebody that just lines up the wrong way. You know that.
Yeah. If you'd have gone all-purpose yards with Jahmyr Gibbs, I probably would have jumped on with you. But, like, I think Ja'Cory Roberson is going to have – he's going to go out. Zay Flowers could have, like, a 200 – could put a 200 burger on somebody, like –
Clemson. Clemson's got 200
people. I
think
you get one of these receivers going off.
Yeah, Clemson. Clemson's got people that go get 200 on you.
They got a couple. But they're going to split the ball up so much. They may have one. They're going to split the ball up so much that it'll happen later, I think.
All right. Josh, next.
All right, Wes, you mentioned Clemson, which leads us perfectly into our next question. What happens first? Clemson loses one game this season, or every team in the Coastal loses two?
Oh, Roddy, you're first.
On this one,
Wes. Oh, really? Come on.
Oh, I'm first. All right, I'll go. I think you have to go with Clemson loses one, right? Like, it's the only pick that you can make here, right? Like, I think you're gonna have two teams out of the Coastal. We talked about this yesterday. I think you've got two teams out of the Coastal that could win 10 games, which would mean only two losses in the regular season. Plus, Clemson could very well lose week one to Georgia, and it would not be a loss that anybody thought twice about. So I'll say Clemson loses one. I don't feel good about it. I don't. But I think if you're going to go odds-wise, that's probably more likely.
That's the one I'm thinking, too, only because at some point along the way here, you know, the evolution of the Clemson program has to take a step, right? And so for that, I would say Clemson loses one. Yeah, and I do believe Carolina and Miami are capable of 10. And so that would negate the question, if you will. That's why I'll go Clemson.
Your reasoning is sound. All right, down in Charlotte, we will, of course, be voting on a number of preseason award winners. But when it comes to postseason awards, what happens first? A defensive player wins ACC Player of the Year. That hasn't happened since 2001 when Maryland's E.J. Henderson did it. Or a wide receiver wins Offensive Player of the Year in the conference. That hasn't happened since 2006 when Megatron did it.
I guess I can't go neither since West could go both. Couldn't go both. I can't go neither.
Correct.
This is going to happen.
You don't think either one's ever going to happen again?
I'm not going to predict it. I mean, certainly one of them could.
Well,
I don't know, West, what are you going to go with?
I'm going to say a defensive player is going to win it before a wide receiver wins it. Because if a wide receiver wins it, it's more or less the quarterback. Now it is. I don't think it was that way with Calvin. I don't think it was that way with Clarkston Hines, which is precursor to Calvin. I think it's a defensive player. I think a defensive player wins, and it's really hard to believe it's been since 01 since a defensive player has won this award. To the point, Roddy, where a name from yesterday's show, I mean, Derwin James was on the way to winning ACC Player of the Year when he got hurt in week two. But I think a defensive player, Brian Brzee, we talked about. I still think we got linebackers in this league. I think we got Bubba Bolden in the secondary at Miami who could get a ton of interceptions.
How did Luke Kuechly not win this thing? I feel like that's a flaw in the system here. He had 7,000 tackles three straight years.
They didn't win enough games. I can tell you how he didn't win it. He didn't win enough games.
Exactly.
They didn't win enough games.
I'm going to go defensive player, and I think it happens in the next 2 years, and here's why. You have a unique set of circumstances where you have a team that's going to have the success in Clemson that we expect them to have, and players who are going to have the type of name recognition that with some stats, some highlight plays, could lead them to winning the overall player of the year. I don't think it happens this year. But I think with Brian Brzee and Miles Murphy, it's setting up where it could very well happen next year because of those factors.
There you go.
Roddy, I do respect the hustle. You went from the beginning of that answer saying, I don't think either will happen in our lifetime, to by the end saying a defensive player will do it within the next two seasons. Respect.
Well, look, I didn't expect that you would track the evolution of my answer.
That was well done.
But, you know, we got there. So
we got there.
We all evolved. That happened in real time.
Nice.
I like it. All right, last one here quickly. This one for all of our Deacon fans out there. What happens first? Nick Skiba misses a field goal or Sam Hartman throws an interception?
Oh,
Hartman
man.
Only threw five all of last year. Skiba is first in ACC history with an .891 field goal percentage.
Old Dominion, Norfolk State, FSU, the first three, Roddy.
I'm going to say Hartman interception. And I'll tell you why. I just think he's going to have more opportunities than Skiba will, and Skiba's automatic. So I'll go Hartman interception.
Sam went 258 last year without throwing an interception. That actually dates back to 19. I'm going to go Skiba misses the field goal.
There you go.
I'm going to go Skiba.
And very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially the thing is they put him out for like a 55-yarder, then your chances go way up there. So some of it's going to be circumstantial.
Well, then
too.
You just said Sam Hartman's going to throw a lot of – I mean, he's going to throw the ball a lot too. So
I didn't
that's
say he's
why you
throw
ran
a lot.
Sam Hartman.
He's going to throw the ball a lot. Yeah, he's going to throw the ball a lot.
So, all right.
You know, tip ball, anything can happen.
All right, when we come back – oh, you don't want to miss this segment. We dive into the vault because one of us on this show has participated in the ACC kickoff twice as a player. Not me. ACC kickoff memories with Roddy Jones. And really, it's about the players he was with, not him, when we come back on Packer and Durham.
Yeah, correct. 100%.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. This is the Packer and Durham Podcast.
Welcome back. Final stretch of the Tuesday show. Don't forget our coverage of the ACC football kickoff begins at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Jim Phillips takes the podium at 9:30 for the Commissioner's Forum. And then for the rest of the afternoon, it's a Coastal Division, players and coaches, and we'll have some other special guests along the way as well. Thanks to my man Roddy Jones here for filling in the last couple days. Our full ACC Network football crew handles our coverage tomorrow and Thursday, and then we're back here with a Friday edition of the show. Speaking of the kickoff, not many players in ACC football history get to go to the kickoff. Fewer go twice. I mean, there have been Heisman Trophy winners made a single appearance at the kickoff. There have been other guys that have made two appearances. There's been a rare three-time appearance at the kickoff. But when you go twice, there's a lot of photo ops. And ladies and gentlemen, if Roddy Jones brings anything to today's show, it's photo ops.
It's
Yep,
there he is. There he is. I'm glad we're all focused on Tyrod Taylor's shorts in this picture. Number five, Virginia Tech jersey. Yep. Look at the star-studded. I want to point out, we've got some other ACC Network guys. Mark Herzlich there on the left, number 94 in that Boston College jersey. You got Matt Bosher standing next to me. Rozai Dowling, 19 for Virginia there. You got DeAndre McDaniel, number 2 for Clemson.
Nate Irving.
Number 58. Yeah. Torrey Smith, a throwback of Maryland in the Atlantic Coast Conference. Yeah. Torrey Smith there.
Wait a second.
Number 82 at receiver.
Wait, hold on. Yeah. Hold on. What's the next to Bosher, who, by the way, nice slacks, Bosher. Roddy, what are you wearing on your feet? That looks like slides with black footies.
No. All black Air Force Ones, low tops. Come on, Wes. This is 2010 in Greensboro. Of course, we were all going for the type of hang time and length that DeAndre McDaniels got on the shorts. Not many of us achieved it. But, you know, we were all going for Anthony Costanzo there on the back row there for Boston College. We got Alan Bailey. And, of course, my boy Jason Peters right behind me with the Georgia Tech jersey. So,
Jason Peters. What a crew.
What a crew we had. The one that we took in Pinehurst, EJ Manuel makes an appearance.
Can
in
we
that
go
one,
back to that one, by the way? The Pinehurst
and some other ones.
Picture?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we get some? I mean,
and that 2011
EJ comes,
pick at Pinehurst.
Yeah. EJ comes clean now. I mean, look at, well, now hang on. Yeah. Manuel.
EJ is on the left hand side. So Luke Kuechly is far left. If you count five guys in with his arms crossed, that's EJ Manuel right there.
EJ's got
the,
slacks on.
The Pinehurst kicker. We got Danny Cole. Yeah, he's got slacks. We all did slacks that year.
Yeah.
But Wes, that trip to Pinehurst was my first time ever playing golf. Just a quick story. We had the opportunity to play golf, and I was not going to. Logan Walls, who I went with, was not going to. And, you know, Paul Johnson, who is a big golf guy, comes up and says, hey, are you guys playing golf? We say, no. I say, coach, I've never played golf before in my life. Definitely not doing it here. He says, you're playing golf for the first time in your life tomorrow at Pinehurst. You're flying home with me. I'm not letting you leave Pinehurst without playing golf. And let's just say, Wes, I don't think Pinehurst has ever been the same. There's probably 700 balls that I hit that are sprayed throughout the course. I do have to say, Paul Johnson made me play and then laughed at me when the first time he saw me swing a golf club. It went really far, just like at a 90-degree angle that way. It was brutal. So Coach Johnson had a good kick out of that one. But my first round was on Pinehurst number 8.
Hey, some people play golf and stop immediately after they play the best course they've ever been on. Sounds like your situation. There you go.
Yeah, exactly. Early on.
Thanks to Andrea Adelson, Eric McLean, Tom Luganville, Drew, Josh, Alex, great job. Roddy, appreciate it. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Our coverage of the Atlantic Coast Conference kickoff starts at 9 a.m. Packer and Durham returns Friday at 7 on ACC Network.
Tune into Packer and Durham weekday mornings from 7 to 10 Eastern for the best conversations about everything from the ACC. Find it on the ACC Network, SiriusXM Channel 371, and streaming on the ESPN app.